you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us wherever you are in Southern California, listening throughout the state of California or across the United States on the KPECC app. Remember, you can take us on your smartphone wherever you go, even plug it into the media center of your car, and you've got Air Talk, you've got NPR programming. Everything is there for you wherever you go and whenever you want to listen. We have some breaking news, and that is the majority of the California congressional delegation, along with Senator Alex Padilla, has sent a letter to President Biden asking that there be a major disaster declaration made for the state of California. This because of the torrential rains that we've experienced, the flooding, the debris flows, all the challenges that we've faced as a result of this series of storms. According to a letter from the members of Congress, they say a wide range of federal assistance programs for individuals and public infrastructure, including funds for both emergency and permanent work from FEMA and other federal agencies, would be attached to that major disaster declaration. So that breaking news. And of course, we'll bring you the president's response whenever we hear that throughout the course of the day. NPR's Here and Now coming up at 11 o'clock right after Film Week, and 1 o'clock is the first hour of NPR's All Things Considered with Austin Cross. But speaking of the storms to come over the weekend that Sharon McNary was just filling us in on, we're going to get a detailed forecast on what the weather will bring us from Eric Bolt, warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service's Oxnard office, which serves the northern portion of the Los Angeles basin. Eric, thank you for joining us again. Please share with us what we're going to be seeing over the next few days. Eric?
A couple more storm systems. Are we there?
Yeah, Eric, are you there? Can you hear us okay? Apparently not.
What? I can hear you.
Can you hear me? Yeah, we sure can. So, Eric, share with us what's to come with the series of storms, please.
Sure. So we do expect two more storms coming in this weekend. We'll be okay today, but there will be some light showers maybe by tomorrow morning. And then a little stronger, more steady rain expected late Saturday afternoon and into the evening hours. So we could pick up another half inch to one inch of precipitation across most of the metro area then. Sunday's looking pretty dry, but then we have another storm right on its heels coming in on Monday on Martin Luther King Day. So another round of rain, very similar to this one, the first one on Saturday night. These two storms, I would call more typical Southern California winter storms. We don't anticipate many impacts, but we know there's a lot of movement of some ground areas out there and some water in our smaller streams and rivers that can cause a few extra rises as we have these next storms come in.
I was looking at forecast for Northern California. One of the concerns was that the Salinas River could crest to the point where it cuts off the Monterey Peninsula from the rest of California because of flooding. That's something that we haven't seen in almost 30 years. Other areas, of course, very concerned about heavy rain. I saw San Francisco was due for heavy rain this afternoon and this evening. You know, what's your sense of what they're going to be facing versus us here in the South?
Well, they have received the brunt of the precipitation and some of the more major impacts to our north, and that's still the case with these next two storm systems. The kind of the focus of the atmospheric river and the more significant rainfall will be to the north, so they are still plagued with these potential impacts going on up there. We're kind of getting a little more lucky down here. We're still seeing some beneficial rains, but we are not anticipating major impacts like they are up north.
And with the storms tomorrow and Monday, are those similar to the ones, even if not quite as intense as what we had earlier this week, but are they still on that same track with a jet stream coming from Japan?
Yes. I mean, this has been one after another impacting the entire state. We're just kind of seeing the weaker side of these storms coming up this weekend. So, yes, we're still in that pattern, still a very strong jet stream clear across the Pacific Ocean, bringing that conveyor belt of moisture into California.
And is there anything that you're seeing that looks like those conditions are going to be broken up, or do you think we're just going to continue to see storms on that track for the foreseeable future?
I think there is some light at the end of the tunnel, as they say. So we do see after these storms, say by Wednesday, the middle of next week, and into the latter part of next week, we do see this pattern breaking down. So we have more of a typical jet stream going up into Alaska, and we kind of get more into high pressure here on the West Coast. So we do see a break in this pattern.
Okay. And that, of course, doesn't mean the end of rain necessarily, because I assume that we could get precipitation that would come down from the north, typically the colder kinds of rainstorms that we way often get in our rainy season here.
That's correct. But, you know, remember last year we did kind of shut off the winter precipitation. We didn't see much for the rest of January and February. We're hoping that doesn't happen. The good news is we are well above normal so far for January and on a good track for our totals at the end of the year.
And, Eric, any thunderstorms in the next two wave of storms?
There have been thunderstorms over the Pacific Ocean with these systems, and the one that we're coming in on Monday will be a colder system, so that brings at least a slight chance of thunderstorms to the area. So that could give us some brief heavy downpours and even some small hail when that comes through Monday.
All right, Eric, thank you so much. Really appreciate the detailed forecast, particularly the longer-term look at what's to come. We appreciate it.
You bet. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service's Oxnard office. Also with us, Los Angeles City Fire Department Public Information Officer Captain Eric Scott. Captain, it's good to have you back with us. Last time we talked, we were talking about some of the rescues that took place early in the week and life-threatening circumstances for people. What sorts of precautions are in place for this coming weekend's rain?
Well, your Los Angeles City Fire Department is definitely leaning forward once again. You know, as Eric Bolt had mentioned, and the National Weather Service are great partners of ours. But we're set to have this another string of storms to come on Saturday through Monday. And we kind of expect this to be a bit colder and not as wet, but the runoff could be quicker to materialize due to the saturation. Or in other words, the sponge is full right now. So our concern is, are we going to have some additional runoff? We saw an abundance of debris flows throughout hillside areas. And so we are surveying those and leaning forward and augmenting resources as necessary.
And, you know, we see the potholes that are in the roads all over the region as a result of this, as water intrusion under the road, you know, causes problems with that. But of course, we had that terrible sinkhole in Chatsworth where two cars and a couple of people had to be rescued. Have we had any more of those even smaller sinkholes, to your knowledge, that have had to be dealt with?
Nothing nearly to that extent. That was a low-frequency, high-risk type of an incident that swallowed up those two vehicles, and we had a very dynamic rescue from them. So, and that actually takes quite a while to happen, meaning that whatever may have failed or water that was getting underneath the roadway was happening for some time, slowly eroding. I went back out to that site again yesterday. It has easily grown 10, 20 times in size to being a cave in some areas. So that was a bit unusual. Without a doubt, our firefighters did an outstanding job rescuing those folks, and we're glad to say there's certainly nothing that if we've come across since then that was anything comparable in size.
So does it look like one of the pipes under there was leaking and that was just exacerbated by the heavy rains and caused that hole to open?
Possibly. You know, there's water pipes running through there. They have large concrete masses that go above them for protection. There's sewer lines that go through there. There's also like what they call a tin whistle nearby, which is a corrugated mess, a metal, a large pipe that comes out of the ground. It's maybe 2 to 3 feet wide and 5 feet tall. But once it goes underneath the ground, it makes a turn under the roadway and then goes off to a steeper hillside where it can dump off into a valley. So there's concern whether that had been functioning properly, but we certainly have a lot of different agencies coming together to help mitigate the long-term effect of that. Because if we look really simply at, you know, emergency management, there's four phases. There's the prevention, the response, the mitigation, and the recovery. Fire department, law enforcement, we're usually there right in the middle, the response and the mitigation. Now that this has been days, it's turned to the recovery. And so now we grab all of our city partners. We come together, we put our heads together, we have important meetings and make progress. And they've already taken those vehicles, removed them out. There was about 30 people there working on that sinkhole yesterday from various agencies. So the LA City folks are definitely taking this serious.
And with the hillsides that have eroded, you've got closures on Mulholland Drive, Hollywood Hills, where homes have been threatened by slides. Anything going on with mitigation efforts still at that point, or is now into the point of trying to fix those problems?
Yes, very, very much the same type of thing with those road closures through Mulholland, Laurel Canyon, Coldwater Canyon, Beverly Glen, areas where we saw it eroding away, and we wanted to stop people from traveling through there so they don't become victims. At this point, it's again one of those long tail effects where we reach out to LA Public Works, Street Services, Department of Transportation, Bureau of Engineering. I could go on and on with our allied agencies that put their arms around resolving this for commuters that we want to stay away from those areas. And we want people to also just do basic things. Heed the signage that's up, obey the traffic officers' instructions that we have posted out there at those closure points.
Thank you very much, Captain Eric Scott, LA City Fire Department. Good to have you with us today. We appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, and we'll hope that Fire Department doesn't have to go into action over the course of the weekend with the rains that are coming. Our KPECC reporter, who typically covers health care, Jackie Fortier, is with us. Jackie, thank you so much. You were out looking at L.A. County-run debris basins, which are designed to keep, you know, boulders and a variety of different debris from coming off of the hillsides into residential neighborhoods and streets. What did you find in your visit to those basins?
Yeah, Larry, I went out to Oak Glade in just north of Monrovia, I should say in the mountains above Monrovia, and it's a debris basin. Like you said, it's kind of like a neighborhood dam. It's actually one of the smaller ones. And this is actually their highest priority right now because it just got packed with sediment that washed down the mountains from the rains that we just had. The reason why it had so much sediment, though, is because it's part of the 2020 Bobcat Fire burn scar. So I'm sure everybody knows this, but I'm going to say it again. Wildfires, you know, burn up a lot of the plants that absorb the rain and the water, and that can cause soil to repel the water instead of absorbing it. So it's kind of like if you think of a parking lot and you just pour water on it, the rain just runs off. So it eventually fills with debris, sediment, mud, you know, anything that washes off the side of a hill. And they're trying to clear that out as quickly as possible because it got so full before the next storm comes because, you know, there's houses just below it.
And explain a little bit how the filtration system works. I found that really interesting in what you wrote about how it's got the tower in it that filters out the water. And then where does that water go?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, too. It kind of looks like a giant Brita filter, and it's concrete, and it kind of sticks out of the middle. So if you think of like a dam, and you're kind of back behind the dam, the water goes into this filter, and so it keeps the rest of it. It's surrounded by basically mud. If you look at the pictures on LAist.com, it'll make a little bit more sense. But the water will, you know, flow into that because water likes to go where it can, and then it gets dumped out at the bottom of the dam into a channel that's already been provided. So what that does is, you know, when we have these major rain events and all this sediment and mud and debris starts getting in there, the water gets separated so it doesn't fill up as quickly. That's why it's designed that way.
Okay. And then that water, it sounds like at this point, it's really not captured necessarily for storage, although I'm sure they'd like to do that ultimately. That just goes into the flood control system.
Honestly, I'm unclear. As you said, I usually cover health. It might be captured. I'm not sure.
I'm sure that's their plan because they want to capture as much of this stuff as they can and get it into spreading grounds and get it into the aquifer so that it can be used. But and you also wrote about why it's so important that people don't go into areas with storm water, according to LA County Public Health. So in other words, don't go swimming right after a storm because of bacterial counts and the like. So your work is available at LAist.com as always. We'll look forward to your continuing coverage. Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you.
Jackie Fortier, KPCC Senior Health Reporter. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Coming up, we have a couple of very positive environmental stories. Isn't that great? We don't get a lot of them. One of them involving what's called carbon capture as a way to try and take CO2 out of our atmosphere and be able to store it someplace. That, of course, in addition to increasingly using renewable energy, all designed to try and cut fossil fuel emissions, which lead to global warming. And we're also going to be talking about the ozone layer and the ozone hole that was a cause of so much concern in scientific circles. We'll get to those when we come back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Film Week is coming up. In our next hour, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the new movie from acclaimed Iranian writer-director Jafar Panahi. He plays a kind of riff on himself in his new film, No Bears. We'll hear all about that coming up with our critics Amy Nicholson and Peter Rayner. But right now, we turn our attention to direct carbon air removal, the ability to take CO2 out of the air and be able to store it somewhere. The company Climeworks AG has announced a major breakthrough verified by a third party that they have used direct carbon air capture technology and been able to show at some degree of scale that they could take it out of the air and store it deep within the earth. Joining us to talk about what this means is Craig Bettenhausen, who's business reporter for Chemical and Engineering News. Craig, thank you very much for joining us. So share with us why this announcement is so significant in this area of study.
This is an interesting bit of news in a couple of different ways. I mean, if we're going to get out of climate change, we need to be able to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, not just emit less of it. And Climeworks has actually been doing that for a couple of months now, for a while at this plant is called Orca. What's especially different this week is that for the first time, they're doing it on a contract basis. So this is, you know, Microsoft, Stripe, and Shopify have, you know, paid on a they're capturing carbon, we're going to pay you for it, and it's done ahead of time. Before they had captured some carbon, maybe it sold some credits, but now there's a real economic model around it, and it's working.
And so the companies use this as a kind of offset for the CO2 that they emit?
Exactly. And it's especially good for companies like these three because they're software companies. So their emissions, their greenhouse gas emissions are mostly related to the electricity that they buy to run their operations. And in other industries like steel and chemicals, you can do, you know, more direct ways to reduce your carbon. But for a software company, this is the route.
So, and we should differentiate. So with the carbon capture that happens on site, let's say you've got a coal burning power plant where you could potentially catch the CO2 before it's emitted. That's one thing. This is different. This is just where the plant is set up and just pulling CO2 out of the air, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So Climeworks' plant, and they're breaking ground on a second larger one. It's going to be pulling the carbon dioxide, that 0.4% directly out of just normal air that you and I are breathing. It's harder than if you're doing it at a flue gas, you know, at a chimney of a chemical plant or a power plant, because coming out of a power plant, you're looking at more like 15 to 30% carbon dioxide, whereas in the air, it's much, much less. So it's a harder challenge to solve.
We're talking with Craig Bettenhausen of the weekly news magazine Chemical and Engineering News. It's published by the American Chemical Society. Also with us is Caltech professor Jess Atkins. He's professor of geochemistry and global environmental science, and he is founder and CEO of Calcaria. It's a carbon capture and storage company based here in Los Angeles. Professor Atkins, good to have you with us.
Really great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
One of the knocks I know, or what some environmental critics have said about this process, is you're always going to have to use more energy to do this than you get out of it. What's interesting about this Climeworks case is they use geothermal power to be able to power the filtration process. And I wonder, is that the hope with all of this? It's renewables that will power the plants.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to keep track of the full carbon lifetime, right, from sort of cradle to grave on your process. That would always require electricity or always somehow not be right on the balance sheet, that's a misconception, right? There are all sorts of different ways that you might think about taking CO2 and storing it safely. And as you guys were talking about earlier, it depends a lot on what its source is. If you start with something more concentrated coming out of a power plant, or in our case, out of the ship stack of cargo ships and bulk carriers, then you're 10 times ahead of the game already. It's already that much more concentrated. And so your power requirements go way down. And it becomes a lot easier to make the whole thing really carbon negative.
And share with us about what your project down at the ports, how that works.
Well, I think what's really cool about Calcaria is a bunch of different things. One, it's grown out of research that we've been doing at Caltech and USC for the last 7 or 8 years. And that's always fun to be sort of bumbling along as a basic scientist and then realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm onto something that might work at the engineering scale. But what's even more fun about it is that we're really part of a kind of growing ecosystem or diaspora of LA-based carbon capture companies, some coming out of Caltech, some coming out of UCLA, many of them ending up at the ports because the ocean is such a logical place to store this carbon. You asked specifically about us, but I'd be happy to riff on the whole group as well. We are going after a process called the accelerated weathering of limestone. The beauty of it, this is what the planet does. We know as geochemists and as climate scientists, this is what I've been doing for my career for decades now, is looking at what are the natural cycles of CO2 going up and down. We know that when volcanoes go off and put extra CO2 into the atmosphere, over the course of tens of thousands of years, of course, the set CO2 reacts with limestone sediments at the bottom of the ocean, with calcium carbonate sediments at the bottom of the ocean. The acid in the CO2 is titrated by the base in the sediments to leave the neutral salts behind. And so in a few tens of thousands of years, all of this fossil fuel, once we stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere, will actually come back down again because of this natural process. In a sense, it's why we're not Venus.
Well, and what keeps that from having upsetting the pH balance? And for example, if you're to do carbon capture and then pump that into the ocean, is that a risk?
So if you put CO2 directly into the ocean, and these were some of the ideas like 15 years ago or so, absolutely, that's accelerated ocean acidification, and that would be something to really worry about. If you first react the CO2 with the base in the limestone, then you're just putting the neutral salts that are already there in great abundance back into the ocean, and there's no effect on the pH whatsoever.
So how do you engineer that process that occurs naturally over tens of thousands of years?
Yeah, so we have been studying the rate at which calcium carbonate dissolves under natural conditions in the ocean. It was actually kind of embarrassing, given ocean acidification happening, that we couldn't tell you if you took this coral and dropped in a beaker and bubbled in CO2, how quickly would it dissolve? And that's when my long-term collaborator and I, Will Burleson, down at USC, got started on this problem. Is just like, come on, what is the rate at which it will dissolve? How is it a function of the pH or a function of the acidity? We managed to make a lot of progress on that problem, which has been a super fun, geeky physical chemistry problem. And then at some point, it was actually literally like while taking a shower, getting ready to go coach my kid's soccer team, I realized, wait, we figured out how the reaction really works. the one that buffers atmospheric CO2 on these natural timescales. Could we scale that up? And I did the whole Eureka thing and like jump out and do a little like write down in pencil and paper. And indeed, it felt like if we could make this reaction go at the rates that we were doing in the lab, we could keep up with the emissions of, say, a cargo ship underway from LA to Shanghai and help to sequester its CO2 safely in the ocean.
Wow. That's remarkable. And so, of course, all of this is getting these projects at scale. And time is not our friend here because of the kinds of deadlines we're trying to look at for irreversible
Absolutely.
Negative climate impacts. So, first of all, what gives you, what heartens you, what gives you hope that this is scalable fast enough?
Well, we're going to go test that all out. In fact, this week we've been installing a reactor down in a parking lot at USC. That is the pilot scale height of what you would use to put on any ship that we're imagining doing. And so we're moving off the lab bench where we've been able to demonstrate that things match up with the equations we write down to actually build a 16-foot tall and 3-foot diameter reactor hooked up to a real diesel generator that we're going to run here for the next 6 to 12 months, testing out exactly that question of how well are we scaling.
And storage is obviously just as important here. You can take it out of the air. You have to have a place to put it, whether it's deep underground, whether it's in the ocean, however you're going to do this. What are the pros and cons of each of those and the challenges that come with each?
Yeah, well, the pros and cons are you need both, right? We tend to shorten everything so you don't know what we're talking about. And so we call this CCS, or carbon capture and storage. And just as you said, it's a two-part process. And Climeworks, bless their souls, they really have been industry leaders in this. They've been going at it longer than most everybody else. And they're all about that first part, that capture. We are focusing on storage, though if we do the ships while they're underway, we'll actually be doing both. We'll be capturing the CO2 while they're underway and storing it safely in the ocean. But there's not really a pro and con about them. You need them both together. Okay. Otherwise, the whole process doesn't work. Otherwise, you just build up huge quantities of CO2 in some corner of the earth.
And explain with the ship that's underway. Is this just captured out of the stacks of the ship, and then it's just immediately after filtration injected like out the back of the ship as it's underway?
That's right. We bubble the exhaust gas of the ship. The idea is that we bubble the exhaust gas of the ship
Wow.
through a chemical reactor that's got the limestone and seawater in it. And that chemical reaction, it's not really a filtration, it's an actual chemical reaction,
Okay.
leaves salty water in the trail behind the ship.
And then, so the question is, what is, if you ended up with old fleets of ships using this process, what would be the, could there be unintended environmental consequences?
Of course, that's an incredibly important question. We understand the chemistry side of it very well. Like we think we really understand, like I was saying before, this process will not have to change the pH of the ocean at all. But, you know, I'm a chemist, and so I worry, is there some bug out there?
Something
where,
you
don't like. Yeah, like where a bug could be something from a microbe to a shark, right, that really likes all that bicarbonate. When I say all that, go do this process, right, and neutralize the shipping industry. About a gigaton of CO2 emitted per year, about 3% of global emissions from all of humanity. We will raise the saltiness of the ocean far less than 1% where we go, less than one part in 1,000. And so there's already a lot of calcium and bicarbonate in the ocean. It's a matter of how quickly is it going to mix, and while that is happening, what might be going on. That's really important to go study, especially from the ecology side. And fortunately, colleagues of mine are going after that question because it's important that that gets done separately from Calcaria.
It makes sense. We're talking with Caltech geochemist Jess Atkins. He's professor of geochemistry and global environmental science, and he's founder and CEO of Calcaria, which is a carbon capture and storage company that's based at the port of Los Angeles, talking about the potential of that technology as just one of the many ways that carbon capture and storage is being developed as a way of dealing with global warming and CO2 emissions. And again, this is not in lieu of building renewable energies. This is not in lieu of moving to all electric vehicles. This is not in lieu of all the other sorts of efforts we're making. This is really about yet another important way of trying to cut CO2 that's in our air. Let me go back to reporter Craig Bettenhausen of Chemical and Engineering News, business reporter for that publication. What sorts of public investment is going into these different enterprises? Of course, you know, you were mentioning with Climeworks AG in Iceland that you got Microsoft, Shopify, and Stripe with contracts are putting a lot of money into it. But are there a lot of government funds?
There are. I mean, one of the big things that's changed in this area very recently is the Inflation Reduction Act, which boosted the carbon capture credits and the direct air capture credits that you can get, you know, from the U.S. significantly. So it went from being about $50 per metric ton for a point source capture, like the kind that Jess is working on, up to $85 per ton. And in direct air capture, it's even more. It's going to be between $130 per ton that you can get as a tax credit, up to $180 a ton. Then that's depending on whether or not you're going to sequester it or if you're going to use it for something. The credit is less if you use it for something. That's a big boost in the amount of revenue that these projects can generate. And it also pushes it over the line of profitability, especially on the point source carbon capture, because that's getting up into the range that, it, you know, the cost of carbon capture at these plants is in a similar range to the tax credits now.
We're talking with Craig Bettenhausen of Chemical and Engineering News. Now, there are environmentalists who say this is really the wrong way to go, that, you know, planting of trees, that natural ways of scrubbing CO2 out of the air is much more cost effective, a better route to go. Share sort of more fully what their argument is, because it seemed to me like, well, that's all well and good, but like anything you could do quicken the pace of this would seem to be positive.
Well, you definitely should plant trees. But the problem with trees as a carbon removal solution is scale and durability. Because a tree can live a long time, but eventually it's going to fall. And when it falls, the carbon that it captured is, you know, re-emitted as that, you know, dead tree decomposes or it burns. The advantage of some of these projects that especially sequester it in geology or use it to make durable materials is that that carbon is locked away in a more permanent sense. The other problem with planting trees is that, you know, you might plant a bunch of trees in Oregon, but that might then, the economics of that shifted things around where you can't grow the corn there, so that corn results in a forest somewhere else being cut down. That's the question of additionality, is, you know, when you make these investments, is it actually something that's not just taken away somewhere else? And so when you're building these plants that can, you know, make it into a rock or make it into a Lego block, you know where it's going and it's not coming out of somewhere else.
All right. And that, in the case of Climeworks, that CO2 that's pumped deep underground, it just forms rock under there?
Yeah, they're working with another, you know, young climate group called CarbFix. And yeah, a chemical reaction happens in the liquid state, and they pump that liquid back down into the bedrock where it reacts into a, you know, permanent mineral. So it's not coming back up in any form.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Professor Jess Atkins of Caltech, thank you for talking about this. And I'd like to revisit this. There's so much interesting stuff I'd like to learn about it. And
yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to
come back anytime.
Yeah.
And I would just add to the list of making rock underground and Legos. The ocean is also can be a perfectly safe place and very, very large place to put the CO2. I think it's pretty exciting times.
Caltech Professor of Geochemistry and Global Environmental Science, Jess Atkins, and Craig Bettenhausen, business reporter for Chemical and Engineering News, a publication of the American Chemical Society. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Coming up, another piece of positive news on the environmental front. We'll get to that in just 90 seconds. Minutes away from Film Week and our critics on KPCC. This week it's Peter Rayner and Amy Nicholson. A lot of movies to talk about, and our John Horn interviews Rian Johnson, the writer-director of Knives Out and the second film in that series, A Glass Onion. That's all coming up on Film Week in just a few minutes. But as I said, another positive environmental news story, Earth's protective ozone layer is slowly but noticeably healing at a pace that would fully mend the hole over Antarctica in about 43 years. That's according to a new UN report. Joining us to talk about it is David Fahey, director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA's Chemical Sciences Laboratory in Boulder, Boulder, Colorado. He's also co-chair of the scientific assessment panel of the Montreal Protocol, which deals very directly with this. Thank you very much, David Fahey, for joining us. We appreciate it. This is terrific news. Let's just go back and look again for those who are less familiar with this. But when did we determine that we had a problem with ozone layer depletion?
Yeah. Well, good morning. Thanks for having me. Yeah, the big alarm bell went off in 1985 when the British Antarctic Survey published a paper that pointed out there was severe depletion every year in the Antarctic springtime, and that it was very anomalous. It really stood out from all the other measurements we had made. Some years before that, it was pointed out there was a chemical threat from the chlorine-containing compounds that we were releasing at the surface, but the impact on the ozone layer hadn't quite been observed. So that's when the alarm bell went off.
All right. And what were the concerns? Why did the depletion of ozone and the hole over Antarctica, why did that pose a threat to our environment?
Because the ozone layer protects us from ultraviolet radiation from the sun. It covers the whole planet and prevents damaging UV radiation from reaching the surface, which affects essentially every life form, including ourselves. And so the thought of losing the ozone layer kind of sends shockwaves through a lot of different lines of thinking. And so the Antarctic ozone hole, even though it's not where a lot of people live, suggested that there were forces afoot that we didn't understand or didn't understand the scale of them.
So in 1987, the Montreal Protocol is agreed to. You co-chair the scientific assessment panel of how that protocol is working. What did the protocol call for?
The protocol recognized that the unbounded release of these kind of chemicals that we all love because they run our refrigerators, et cetera, the unbounded release would eventually seriously damage the ozone layer. And in 1987, they already had some lingering evidence of this from the ozone hole. But in 1987, the science wasn't fully worked out. So it was very forward thinking of the protocol to set in place a process that would impose some controls if the science continued to point in this direction.
Chlorofluorocarbon 11, one of the chemicals that is banned out of this. What do you see as the pace of the repair? I know it's a long-term process, but in assessing this, were you at all surprised that once that class of chemicals was banned, that you started to see repair rather quickly?
Well, that's one of the issues, is that it took a long time for these chemicals to build up over several decades, but they reached their peak emission before the year 2000, and now the accumulation of those emissions in the atmosphere is on decline. And as you stated earlier, we're expecting the Antarctic ozone hole to not disappear until past mid-century. And it's because of the slow rate that these chemicals that have accumulated in the atmosphere will actually be removed. And so humans don't have the ability to speed up natural processes. So we're waiting. Okay. And we're actually in a vigilance mode where we're paying attention to what's going on in the atmosphere and kind of tracking the decline of these compounds and the recovery of the ozone layer.
Were there concerns with the banning of these classes of chemicals that it would be difficult to replace them? You know, what would you use if you didn't have Freon as a refrigerant or control Freon? What would happen with even something as common as hairspray if you couldn't use the aerosol compounds that were used as part of that? And, you know, how big of a challenge was it for consumer products to respond to that?
Well, this is a really good question. And the Montreal Protocol is considered the most successful environmental treaty in history. And one of the reasons is that it took into account these aspects of controlling compounds that we already had a dependence on. And so part of its process in controlling these substances and phasing them out of global use was the replacements. What would we be using in place of these compounds? And so, we're decades past the 1987 start of the Montreal Protocol, but we all still have affordable refrigerators. And the developing world also has growing dependence on refrigeration. And so this came about because there were replacement compounds identified that destroyed ozone less aggressively than the CFC-11, for example, that you point out. And then the second stage was to transition to compounds that didn't destroy ozone at all. So this was managed technically and economically in a very sure-footed way by the protocol, so that the uses we had would continue.
And so now we're looking at what's the estimate from the UN report, 43 years from now, the hole would be fully repaired over Antarctica?
Yeah, that's today's assessment. We've been watching this for a number of years, and projecting what ozone will do in the future is not a really precise process. And we note that ozone is kind of a living element of the stratosphere, meaning it's produced and destroyed constantly. So it's a dynamic kind of component of the stratosphere. And so in projecting future ozone, we need to know about all of these factors, not just the chlorine that we put there. And one of the key factors is climate change, that's changing the atmosphere that the ozone layer is recovering in compared to the one that it declined in. But it's a pretty robust number in the sense of plus or minus some fraction of a decade in today's in our current assessment.
David Fahey, thank you so much for talking with us about the positive report about the healing of the ozone layer. We appreciate your joining us very much. Have a good weekend.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A director of NOAA's Chemical Sciences Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado, and the co-chair of the scientific assessment panel of the Montreal Protocol that was signed on to back in 1987 by countries around the world that they would ban a class of chemicals often used in refrigerants and aerosols that contributed to the eating away of the ozone layer. It is a big ecological victory, and we celebrate positive environmental news. So good to be able to talk about that, particularly going into the weekend. Coming up, we're going to talk about tomorrow afternoon's wild card NFL football game between the LA Chargers and the Jacksonville Jaguars. We'll preview that matchup in just 1 minute. Eight and a half minutes to Film Week. That's radio time. We're very exacting. Film Week coming right up. Our critics, Amy Nicholson and Peter Rayner, much to talk about. But we're going to preview tomorrow afternoon's NBC televised game of the LA Raiders against the Jacksonville Jaguars. The game is in Florida because Jacksonville won the NFL South Division. Even though the Chargers have a game better record, they are wild card team from the West in the AFC. Joining us to talk about the matchup is Chargers reporter for the Sporting Tribune, which covers West Coast teams. It was founded just last year. Fernando Ramirez joining us. Fernando, thank you very much for being with us. And you have some breaking sports news. Receiver Mike Williams, he's out, I understand.
Yes, sir. He's out for the game. First of all, thank you for having me on. A pleasure to jump on. Mike Williams is out. He will not travel with the team to Jacksonville. He will stay behind and get back treatment. According to numerous reports, he's going to be out for a while. His back is not taken to the treatment that he was given. So according to multiple reports, he wouldn't come back until the Super Bowl if the Chargers were able to make it that far. But they're going to have a hard enough time this weekend against a very young and aggressive Jacksonville Jaguars team.
Well, and a team that in week three blew out the Chargers at SoFi Stadium. Trevor Lawrence looked all world, the quarterback for Jacksonville in that game. Now, I know there was some injuries the Chargers were dealing with and all, but Jacksonville's been really hot. They won their last five games.
Yeah, Jacksonville went through after they beat the Chargers, they went through a lull where they were losing to some terrible teams, and everybody's like, well, what's going on with this Jacksonville team? And they turned it around. They went, like you said, they went on that roll. And that's what happens when you have a Super Bowl winning head coach like Doug Peterson, who's done it before. He's been there before. He has a young quarterback, an aggressive offense, a very good defense that just is missing a couple of pieces. But this team is young. But they're aggressive and they're going to get after it. So they're a very good team. And Doug Peterson has these guys rolling at the right time.
Brandon Staley, the Chargers head coach, has taken plenty of heat in the final meaningless game of the season against Denver, playing Williams and keeping other starters out there. You know what, at this point, is that criticism still front and center against him?
It is, and he actually stood by his conviction again on Thursday afternoon when we spoke to him before the team's last practice. He stood by it. He said, "Yeah, we needed to go roll in there with momentum." Well, guess what? Momentum just cost you your best wide receiver, and you're going to go in there shorthanded now, and so obviously that's going to hurt them. That's going to hurt their offense. Big time, especially because of how much Williams has meant this season. But the reasons why I wouldn't have played Williams or Keenan Allen were both of their top receivers have been injured all season long. So why would you risk them in the final game of the season? He decided to risk them, and he stood by his conviction again on Thursday. So let's see if what happens. If they end up losing, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to his future as the head coach of the Los Angeles Chargers.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the whole chemistry, the offense running on Herbert's ability to find Williams and that receiving core. So this is a big hit for the team, no question. On the defensive side, linebacker Joey Bosa, how is he looking coming back from injury?
Oh, he's looked good. He had a sack last weekend against the Denver Broncos, and he had a couple of pressures. So he should be good to go. It seems like he doesn't have he won't be slowed down. They won't have him on the snap count. It seems like he's gonna be good to go for however long he can. Obviously, he's still coming back from that injury and the surgery, but I'm sure the Chargers will be you'd hope they'd be smart with the way they're going to play him, especially because he's coming back from that injury. But Joey looked pretty good against Denver, so I expect him to look good against Jacksonville as well, just because they're going to need him. They're going to need Khalil Mack and that defense to step up, especially with the offense kind of reeling without Mike Williams.
Well, and Fernando, you know, the question I have is, you know, can they shake up Trevor Lawrence enough to get him off of his game? Because he just could sit back. I think they only pressured him once in that game, third game of the season. I mean, that's astonishing. So if he has that kind of time to throw, the Chargers are in bad shape.
It's funny you mentioned that, because there's a page that we can go to where it shows you quarterback hits, sacks, and everything. When I look back at that game, it was pretty much clean on the Charger on the Jaguar side. It just had one quarterback hit from a Charger defender, and for the Charger, it was Justin Herbert got hit 8 times. He had this, he had that. So it was a different looking chart. But this game, they're going to have to be quick. Trevor Lawrence gets the ball out very quick. So I expect the Chargers to go in there like they did against the Dolphins and maybe try and press coverage their receivers, try and get them off their slant routes, their out routes, try and get them to really get off their line and maybe disrupt Trevor a little bit. And then different kind of pass rush. What it means is you're going to have to bring in a corner, some Derwin James sneaks through and tries to pressure Trevor. You're going to have to throw a lot of different things at him because this kid does it quickly, and he gets the ball out, I think, in less than 3 seconds. So that's Tom Brady. That's at the level, wow, of Tom Brady, where you're just hiking it. Literally, you're finishing the word hike, yeah, and you're already getting rid of the ball. So they're going to have to do a lot to disrupt this young kid.
Well, and Lawrence had that even in college. It was astonishing, oh, yeah, to see a young player with that quick release. And so you got two great young quarterbacks going head-to-head in this playoff
with
game.
With great hair.
Yeah, it's going to be... I love it. We'll end on that. That's a great comment. Fernando Ramirez joining us. Thanks so much, Fernando. We appreciate your setting the scene for the big game tomorrow.
Of course. Have a great weekend, and I hope everybody enjoys the playoff football. It's finally here, so it's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah, Thank you so much for having me on.
How can we not? It'll be a great weekend. Fernando Ramirez is Chargers reporter for the Sporting Tribune. Now, it is a three-day weekend for many people. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is Monday. We're going to be off for the holiday. 1A will air from 9 to 11 o'clock on Monday because of the holiday, and I'll be back with you Tuesday, our usual time, coming right out of Morning Edition. Stay tuned. Film Week is coming up next. The critics will be joining me, and we'll hear all about the new movies of the week. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us, and we're joined by critics Peter Rayner and Amy Nicholson. Amy's film writer for the New York Times and host of the podcast Unspooled, and Peter is film critic for the Christian Science Monitor. We begin with the Iranian drama written and directed by Jafar Panahi, No Bears, a romantic themed story. Peter, what did you think of No Bears?
This is a terrific movie, and you know, you don't have to know anything about Panahi's embattled career to appreciate it, but it certainly increases the film's poignancy. It was filmed several months before he was sentenced to 6 years in prison in July for, quote, propaganda against the Islamic Republic. So he joins the fate of many of his country's artists. It's a difficult film to talk about, you know, because it's sort of a meta movie. It's a film within a film, and Panahi, as he has done in a number of his earlier films, is essentially playing himself, a character named Jafar Panahi, who is a film director. Well, when the film opens, it's a Turkish town bordering Iran, and we're thrust into a kind of extended street-side argument between this couple that are desperate to flee to France, and then it soon becomes clear that what we're watching is not an actual event, but a staged event for a movie that Panahi is directing remotely via video call from a bordering village in Iran, despite the bad Wi-Fi, and he's taken a covert residence in this village in order to make this movie because he's been banned from making films, as has the actual director who's making the movie, if you understand me.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's this sort of Hall of Mirrors dramaturgy, this meta dramaturgy going on in this film, but it never turns into anything pretentious or artificial. The director Panahi, who's in the village, he's regarded suspiciously by the villagers, because even though he's well known and he's a celebrity of sorts, he has a kind of gruff sense of entitlement, and he has his city ways don't really impress the village elders, and there's a moment when they think he's taken a photo of some illicit lovers, which he probably hasn't, but they firmly ask to see him and take an oath on the Quran and in this what's called a swear room, as prescribed by custom, that he did not shoot the photo, and he agrees grudgingly to do this, but he wants to film himself taking the oath. And, you know, there's a lot of village lore in this film, a lot of ancient ritual and all sorts of observations that move beyond the ethnographic, because Panahi is such a humanist filmmaker that the story really resonates on many, many levels. It's really, you know, quite an amazing film. Panahi has a history of doing whatever he can to make movies. In 2011, when he was under house arrest, he made a film called This Is Not a Film. He smuggled it out on a USB port with concealed in a cake and mailed it to the Cannes Film Festival.
Wow.
You know, so he really and when No Bears showed at the New York Film Festival a few months ago, he obviously wasn't there to attend, but one of the actresses in the film read a statement from him. And I think the statement summarizes why this film, even though it has, you know, a lot of heavy going baggage and a tragic undertone, is not despairing. And I think it's because he equates filmmaking with freedom. And what he said in the statement was that the hope of creating again is a reason for existence. And I think that really comes through strongly in this film.
We're talking about the Iranian film No Bears. Amy, what did you think?
I mean, this film is terrific. And what I really appreciate about Panahi is it will be really easy for himself, playing himself, to play himself the way I think the West really likes to see him, as this heroic rebel, this artist who's being so brave and just continuing to make films in Iran, where people are being executed again right now. And yet, the way he characterizes himself in the film is as a bit of an accidental disruptor, as a bit of a curmudgeon, you know, who gets treated with some more deference than he deserves and then some more bewilderment and hostility than he deserves. But he's very clear in the way that his presence disrupts both the couple that he's cast as actors on one side of the Turkish border and the young couple that he's being accused of photographing on his side of the border. That as much as, you know, cultural laws in the state are to blame for these relationships getting disrupted, he himself feels some responsibility. And there's these really nice metaphors in it. You feel the lack of himself as a presence on his own sets as he's trying to direct over a Zoom sort of equipment. And you feel how to even exist on his side of the border, he's denying his own art. He's denying he's taking photos. He's denying that he is, you know, photographing at all. And the way that the villagers treat him is just fantastic. Like, they're very friendly and polite, but with an unnerving tone to everything. All the threats here are delivered with a smile. And what I appreciate probably the most in this film is that with all of this kind of tumult of culture and people disrupting other people's ability to live and feel free, the character that you might most consider the villain in this film, you know, a groom who considers himself betrayed, but now he allows that character to give a good speech in his own defense about the collapse of tradition and how if these traditions that we consider to be baroque and hostile and limiting towards women, that they are collapsing in his own lifetime, how that would affect him. And, you know, he sticks up for himself just enough.
No Bears is the film from writer, director and star of the film, Jafar Panahi. The film is unrated. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Saint Omer is a French drama directed by Alice Diop, who co-wrote the screenplay with Amrita David and Marie Ndiaye. Amy, what did you think of Saint Omer?
Yeah, this is France's Oscar submission, and it's not an easy film to watch. It is about as stern and restrained as they come. It's based on a real-life case in 2016, a French court case where a woman, a Senegalese immigrant named Fabienne Cabou, was convicted of drowning her infant daughter when her daughter was 15 months old. And Fabienne admitted that she did this, but said that she was under the kind of compelled by the powers of witchcraft. And Alice Diop, who made this film and is also a Senegalese immigrant herself, found herself really compelled to go to this trial. She attended it, and she turned her experience of watching this woman take the stand into this film, where she writes herself an on-screen counterpart, a novelist named Rama, who is played by Kaiji Kagami, and she's watching a woman named Laurence Cooley kind of go through a lot of the same testimony. A lot of this is sort of taken word for word from the transcripts. So it's really a film about watching the watcher deliver watching somebody deliver this really compelling and dignified testimony, and then seeing all the people in this French courtroom either listen without hearing or, you know, listen and sort of think she's lying. You get the sense that Rama, as an immigrant herself, as a woman kind of whose life parallels the accused murderess in many ways, is the only person who really understands what the argument that she's making, and her understanding herself makes her a little bit uncomfortable. Again, it's not an easy film to watch. You really have to be in the mood for something uncompromising. And I'll admit, it took me 3 times to really sit down and watch this with like the absolute focus it deserves. It's a very, very static film that's all delivered in kind of really strict monologues.
Saint-Omer, the French film we're talking about, France's official Oscar submission. Peter?
This is a very powerful and very perplexing film, and it is hard to watch. The way that it sort of bifurcates the story between Rama, who is attending the trial, who's, you know, a philosophy professor and a novelist, and Lawrence, the woman who's on trial, the parallelism of their lives, I thought, was a little bit pat, in the sense that, you know, the sort of one-to-one correspondence between one and the other sometimes, I thought, was a little bit too pronounced and detracted from the power of the woman on trial, whose story, I think, is, for me, the central conundrum of this film and of this story. But there's a lot of philosophical overlay to the proceedings. Rama is not only a philosophy professor, but, you know, a novelist who discusses in her classroom about the works of the French writer Marguerite Duras. And, you know, so there's a lot of that kind of stuff in the film to sort of tone it up, which I didn't think it actually needed. In some ways, I wish that the film had been just a straight courtroom drama without the parallelism of the two women, because I think that it doesn't really add to the power of what's going on in the courtroom. Because ultimately, the crime that this woman has committed is so horrendous that you reach for a reason for why this happened, and the film doesn't really provide it. The character is, you know, stoic, and you're not sure sometimes if she's purposely stoic or just that's a mask, or whether she truly believes in the fact that, you know, she was under the cursed, and, you know, there's all sorts of things in this film that come through without the need of this parallelism. Rama is also trying to make a connection between the woman on trial and the myth of Medea, who killed her children because she was, you know, spurned by her husband. So there's a lot of stuff roiling around in this film, but what it left me with was this image of the woman on trial and this sort of existential conundrum, this mystery of why she did what she did.
Saint-Omer is the French film, again, from director and co-screenwriter Alice Diop. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. Jethika is a comedic thriller starring Callie Hernandez, written and directed by Peter Oz. Amy?
This is a delightful small little film. It's just 71 minutes. I think I'll even talk about it kind of brief to just capture the vibe of why this is a really worthwhile movie to watch. It's about a girl named Elena who's like hiding out in the desert for reasons that she's explaining in the framing story of this film. She's hiding at her grandmother's trailer in New Mexico. She's a little bit of a witchy type, you know, candles and crystals everywhere, and she's hiding from something very bad that she's done. When she has a really coincidental run-in with a girl that she used to know at high school, they run into each other at a gas station. This girl is also on the run from her stalker named Kevin. And then Kevin appears outside their trailer, and Kevin should not be there, and he cannot be there. And it's supernatural why he is there. And I will say that this supernatural version of Kevin, the joke of it is that he's just as annoying as her stalker was in real life. He's just this obsessive dork outside their trailer, ranting and railing. And it's very, very funny, although about the 300th time you hear him yell Jessica, you're kind of sick of hearing the name Jessica. That's about all I want to say about the setup, except it's just really fun. It makes a feint at being scary, a feint at being a comedy. What it really does at the end is it has a grace that it didn't have to provide, but it really does provide a grace to these characters.
We're talking about the comedic thriller Jethika, I guess because that's how the stalker pronounces her name. Is that right, Amy?
I was waiting for that. I was like, are they going to punch him in the face and then he's going to start pronouncing it with a lisp? But he says it pretty much just right most of the time.
All right. Jethica is the title of the film, J-E-T-H-I-C-A. It's unrated and it's at the Lumiere Cinema Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. Also, do want to let you know that our Film Week Academy Award annual program is going to be at the Orpheum Theater, the historic, beautiful theater on Broadway in downtown Los Angeles. We're back in that historic theater district, but at a new venue right across the street from where we've done our last several Film Week programs. We hope you'll join us at the Orpheum Sunday afternoon, March 5th, the 21st annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. Tickets are on sale now. Go to laist.com/events. That's laist.com/events to get your tickets. All of our Film Week critics are on stage. They'll be talking about all the Oscar-nominated films in the major categories. It's a chance for audience members to also vote for their picks, and that's a fun aspect of the program as well. Be a great Sunday afternoon. Come see the event in a beautiful, restored historic theater, the Orpheum, on Broadway in downtown Los Angeles, Sunday afternoon, March 5th. Tickets at laist.com/events. We have many more films to talk about with Amy Nicholson and Peter Rayner when we come back in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Peter Rayner and Amy Nicholson. Next up is the action thriller Plane, starring Gerard Butler. The film is directed by Jean-Francois Richet. Charles Cumming and J.P. Davis are the screenwriters. Peter, what did you think of Plane?
Well, I really enjoyed this in a sort of old school, guilty pleasures kind of way. The title itself, they don't mess around. Plane. That's it. You know, it's like a meet Tarzan, Eugene.
It's like airport or hotel.
No, I mean, there isn't even an explanation. They should have at least put an exclamation point after it. But no, it's just plane. You would think that this would be one of those movies from the way it opens that basically is a plane in peril film. Brody Torrance is the name of Gerard Butler's character. A great name. I don't know where they come up with these names. He's a pilot for Trailblazer Airlines, and he's stationed in Singapore, and he's flying a small passenger list to Tokyo, and then he's moving on to, hopefully, to Maui, where he's going to reunite with his college-age daughter for New Year's Eve. So right away we know that ain't going to happen.
It's not going to happen, yeah.
No. And on the plane, one of the passengers is an accused murderer who is being extradited with his FBI handler in handcuffs. He's played by Mike Coulter, and he's very shifty-eyed, so we figured...
This is a throwback, Peter. I just sounds like something out of the 70s.
Yeah, no, it is. It's one of those 70s throwbacks, but, I think we need that now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not Southwest Airlines, by the way. It's Trailblazer Airlines.
Okay.
To make a long story short, that isn't what transpires. The plane is hit by lightning. All the systems go out. They crash land on a remote Philippines island that turns out to be ruled by violent separatists in the jungle. And the crew and the captain have to sort of fend for themselves with this going on. And Brody Torrance teams up with the accused murderer to try to save the day and the passengers. So there's a lot of fighting. There's a lot of jungle activity. There's a lot of chokeholds. There's a lot of everything. It's very well done for what it is. The action scenes are good. And Gerard Butler is just really good at this kind of, sensitive, no-nonsense action hero type. I just remember when he was playing King Leonidas in the film 300. And at one point, you know, he loses an eye in battle and he goes, "It's okay, I have another one." so he's just really good.
He won't be thrown.
I enjoyed this movie. It has guilty pleasure stamped all over it.
Plain is the movie. Amy, what do you think?
I wanted to enjoy it a little bit more because there are some fun ideas here, especially after the last month of air travel that we've all survived in this country. Seeing this Trailblazer Airways get poked at repeatedly is very funny. You know, the crisis starts because some middle manager guy is trying to save a few bucks of gas. There's really fun corporate tension all the way throughout. You realize that Gerard Butler's pilot has had some issues with angry passengers. Even when he's in trouble, he can't get through airline customer service. There's this corporate crisis guy who shows up and announces that the airline has like mercenaries who can get to this island before anybody else does. So there's all these fun ideas that sprout up at the beginning. And I was really like, this movie might be good. Their very first fist fight, really great grapple, long, sloppy, kind of single camera tracking. I was like, oh, this is great. And then about halfway through, guns come out and I found it, got it getting really boring. It just turned into everybody's only as important as how many bullets they have. And you're waiting for things like the passengers to have any sense of personality, but they kind of just stay a herd of people. And even the felon winds up not having that much role to play in the story. And I was like, this is half of a great movie. It reminded me of that illustration of a beautiful pencil drawn horse that turns into a stick figure at the end. I was like, oh, you're almost there in being my very dumb, beautiful pencil drawn horse.
Plain is the action thriller starring Gerard Butler. Jean-Francois Richet is the director. Charles Cumming and J.P. Davis wrote it. It's rated R and in wide release. Skinna Marink is a Canadian horror film starring Lucas Paul, Dolly Rose Tetreault, and Ross Paul. The film was written and directed by Kyle Edward Ball. Amy, what did you think of Skinna Marink?
Well, it is only January, but this might be the most divisive horror film of 2023 if people actually go see it. I might hate it myself. It's kind of hard to tell. It's an experimental horror story with no clear story at all. It shuns the idea of story. It's supposed to instead evoke the feeling of a nightmare. The director asked a lot of people on the internet, what is a nightmare? They have a lot. People came up with the idea of being a child in a dark house when your parents aren't there to comfort you. And that's really the film he made. There are two kids in a dark house. They're very young and small. You never see their faces. You're really just sort of watching from a low angle as they kind of walk through this house, staring up at door frames, yelling out for their parents. Sometimes the door frames disappear. It's just a lot of static shots where it's shot in this kind of old film grain. Everything's gritty. You find yourself staring into the darkness as it holds these static shots, wondering if there is something there on purpose, maybe not. I feel like this film will be very popular with the ASMR crowd because it's all just like fuzzy, staticky shots of like humming room tone, little kid feet on carpet, lots of hisses. There's a demonic voice that says things that I could not understand if the film wasn't occasionally subtitled, not always subtitled. I found myself really getting my attention drifting to the fact that there's a TV that's playing a lot of old Max Fleischer style cartoons. And they also have that kind of sense of surreality, nightmarish images, things that are sort of funny but not funny. I want to say that this film might work better in a theater, although I did see the trailer for this film at an AMC at the Americana. And when the trailer was up, a woman sitting behind me just yelled, "I hate it." And that made me want to go see this movie. So maybe whatever I'm saying here will make other people want to check it out for the same reason. I'm curious. I'm very curious how this is going to play out for people.
Skinna Marink, Canadian horror film, written and directed by Kyle Edward Ball. It's unrated. According to Rolling Stone magazine, made on a micro budget of $15,000, the film is in wide release. The horror film The Offering stars Nick Blood and Emily Wiseman, Oliver Park, the director, Hank Hoffman, the screenwriter, and it's apparently based on a Jewish folktale. Peter, what did you think of The Offering?
Yeah, well, for what it is, it's effective. An actor appropriately named Nick Blood plays Arthur, who's the son of a Hasidic funeral director in Brooklyn. And he's sort of the prodigal son. He returns home with his pregnant Gentile wife to the father that he's been estranged from. The father didn't attend the wedding. The son has been living in England. He's a real estate agent, but he's come to make amends. And the father is surprisingly very open-armed about the return. The father is played by Alan Cordner, a wonderful British actor who's been in a lot of Mike Leigh movies, topsy-turvy. So it turns out that the son is really there because he hasn't closed a deal in 2 years, unbeknownst to his wife, and he needs his father's. He needs a loan from his father in order that they won't lose the home and all the rest of it. But he also dissects a cadaver in the morgue, which is conveniently located in the basement of the home. And from that, it transpires that there is a child-stealing demon at loose, and it becomes a kind of, you know, gory horror fest involving a lot of Kabbalistic esoterica. And it's effective. It's well done. I am a little dubious about, you know, using this sort of thing for, you know, the purposes of Gothic horror. But then again, you know, that's what they do. I mean, The Omen, The Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby, The Vigil, which also had a Jewish subtext. It's very well done for what it is, but I do think it goes a bit off the rails, even by the horror film standards, with, you know, giant goat head monsters and stuff that we would probably be better off seeing in flashes rather than full face. But if you like this sort of thing, it's a good ride.
The Offering is rated R. It's at the Alamo Drafthouse in downtown L.A. and available on demand. The Seven Faces of Jane stars Gillian Jacobs and Joel McHale. The film is written by Jacobs and directed by 8 different directors. Amy, what did you think of the drama The Seven Faces of Jane?
Yeah, this film is an anthology film with kind of a unique presence. It's about a mother who drops her daughter off at summer camp, drives away on her own adventure, and then the adventures that she has are done kind of like a feature film version of Exquisite Corpse, where each of the directors are contributing an installment in her adventure, but none of them have seen each other's segments. And so they're all very wildly different, even though they're following the same character, although I feel like even calling her character is a bit of a stretch. You know, there's not really a central personality to Jane, and like her costuming, makeup, the way she carries herself kind of changes from segment to segment. She experiences like a crime, but she goes to a dance ballet. She meets a couple exes and makes some friends. It's done in like a poetic style or a naturalistic style. It's done in a noir. There's a few in here that really pop. Surprisingly, the one that I love the most was directed by Ken Jeong, you know, the actor from The Hangover, who was a co-star with Gillian Jacobs in the TV show Community. It's her and another guy from Community, Joe McHale, playing this kind of lovers who never quite got to date. And it's a really beautiful segment. There's also a great one where she meets a teenage girl played by Daniela Hernandez, who's running away from her own quinceañera. They have a really fun spark. Rita Wool shows up in kind of a Lynchian one where you learn that Jane used to be an actor. Most of these aren't that compelling on their own, but it is nice as an exercise of seeing that Gillian Jacobs is an actress that I don't think we have used enough out of. She has a lot of range. She has a lot of presence. And it feels like this exists really most of all just as an insistence that we give her more challenges as an actress, because I feel like she can really handle them.
The Seven Faces of Jane is unrated. It's at Lemley's Glendale Theater, the Cine Lounge Sunset Theater, and also available on streaming services, The Seven Faces of Jane. The biographical drama Dog Gone stars Rob Lowe. Stephen Herrick is the director, Nick Santora the screenwriter. Peter.
Yeah, well, on a scale of 1 to 5, I would give this film 1 woof. I like dog movies for the most part, even when they're not good, just because I like dogs. But this one is just so shameless. It just pulls out all the, you know, dog movie cliches, also all the father-son bonding cliches. It's about a college, recently graduated college kid, Fielding, played by Johnny Bertholdt, who doesn't really know what he's doing with his life, and his father is not amused with that. He thinks that the son should be shaping up and doing something constructive. The son has this dog that he's recently adopted named Gonker, this fluffy golden retriever, very friendly dog, who they proceed to lose on the Appalachian Trail, Fielding and his college buddy, played by Nick Payne. So the whole movie is basically at that point, you know, finding this dog, and they post, notices all over the place on the internet, everywhere else. Everyone joins on the search on the Appalachian Trail, and father and son bond on the trail, of course, and the mother. It also has her issues. When she was a young girl, she had the Japanese Akita that was killed, and her unfeeling parents weren't too helpful about that. So we keep cutting to flashbacks of the mother as a child. It's all just totally shameless and by the book. I like Rob Lowe a lot. I think he's a really funny actor and a funny guy, and he wrote a very funny memoir. And I'm sure that when he was making this movie, his tongue was firmly in his cheek, because there's lines that he delivers and scenes that he's in that he couldn't possibly be taking seriously. but as dog movies go, I think it's a dog.
Doggone, streaming on Netflix. It's unrated. Amy, you have a fairly quick thought about this?
Well, I will say that I was excited to see it, weirdly, because the director, Stephen Herrick, did some of my favorite kid movies in the 80s. Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. This doesn't feel like a film by the same director at all. You know, it's very goofy, oversaturated, colorful, saccharine. You go to a biker bar and the meanest thing that anybody says to each other is idiot. You know, it's that kind of movie. The best part is just the credits, where like the cast and crew are all there with pictures of themselves and their own dogs. And I just got myself caught up in looking at all the names of everybody's dogs and wondering if there are going to be any cats. And there were three cats. So good for the cats.
Doggone is unrated, streaming on Netflix. And just a reminder that Peter and Amy and all of our other Film Week critics will be on stage at the historic theater on Broadway in downtown Los Angeles, the Orpheum, our new home for the Film Week Academy Awards preview. The 21st annual edition will be Sunday afternoon, March 5th. Tickets are now available. Make sure you get your seat. It's going to be wonderful. Exactly a week before the Oscars are given out, go to laist.com/events, laist.com/events. Get your tickets, and we'll see you there at the Orpheum on Sunday afternoon, March 5th. Ryan Johnson, director of the Knives Out 2 films, coming up with John Horn. It's Film Week on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Ryan Johnson's movies are like puzzles, and usually one character who can solve them. In Johnson's latest film, Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery, that person is Detective Benoit Blanc. He's back, played by Daniel Craig. Since the film premiered on Netflix in late December, Glass Onion's been one of the streaming service's most popular films ever. Our John Horn spoke to director Johnson the other day, and he started by playing him a clip from the director's DVD commentary on one of his earlier films.
Hello, this is Ryan Johnson, and welcome to the extended and deleted scenes section of the DVD. There weren't a lot of scenes that were completely cut out of the movie, just because the plot is so intricate that there's kind of like a string of dominoes. We couldn't take anything out.
You're not talking about either Glass Onion movie. What are you talking about there?
If I had to venture, I guess Looper. Is that Looper?
Brick. Brick.
Oh, it's Brick.
2005.
That makes more sense, actually.
But
wow.
But the fact that you said Looper, I think, proves my point that there is a mathematical formula. And I don't know if this Hollywood thing didn't turn out, if you'd be some sort of astrophysicist, but there's a mathematical formula to your movies going all the way back to Brick, that if you move one piece out, the whole thing kind of collapses. And I think that's true of the Glass Onion movies. And have you ever thought about that? That, I mean, you thought this was Looper, that there's a structure to your films. You know, everybody has structure, but this is like, you know, you called it dominoes. You take one out and they all start falling over.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of that probably comes from the way I learned to write movies. I learned to write movies starting with structure. I love structure. And I feel like people who can sometimes hit kind of a distrust of it, kind of a sense from some people that structure leads to like a rote sort of formulaic approach to writing, or it can't lead, or it negates the element of surprise, because if you know what's coming, the audience will too, or what have you. That's, for me, it's the exact opposite. For me, I start with the shape of the movie, and that's what structure is essentially for me, is the shape of the movie. And that contains all the things that aren't cold and structural that contains the theme of the movie and the emotional impact it's going to have on the audience. All of that is, for me, starts with this shape that I draw on a little piece of my notebook that that is kind of how the whole movie is going to flow. It's a skeleton of it. So I think starting with that maybe is what leads to maybe that effect that you're talking about.
I said Glass Onion movies. Let me just say Knives Out movies.
No, Glass Onion. But I love that you said that, though, because that's my goal with these things, is that it won't be, you know, the Knives Out franchise. Knives Out was the first movie. Glass Onion was like, I want people to refer to them by whatever the most recent movie is. So thank you. I take that as a win.
You said when you start to draw in your notebook, are you talking about writing down words, or is it really, I'm thinking of that Charlie Day meme or Glenn Beck's chalkboard where these all randomly interconnected lines. Is that, do you start visually, like drawing structure before you're writing words or character?
Yeah, it's like that meme, but a little more insane.
Glenn Beck. Full Glenn Beck.
It's the only aspect of my life in which I go full Glenn Beck. What I'll do is, especially like when I'm at the start, which I am now on the third movie, you know, it's a combination of kind of free flow writing, just kind of almost the equivalent of it's not journaling, but it's just keeping my hand moving while I'm thinking. It's kind of a way of thinking out loud on paper. And then little ideas will like, oh, this is interesting, that's interesting. At some point, though, when I'm ready to actually get started, I will draw a line, and it is a graphic thing. I have a really specific way I do it. I don't think I have one in this notebook that I'm waving in front of the camera that nobody can see who's listening to this.
It's okay. We can explain on radio.
Basically, I'll draw an arc across, and it's a pocket-sized moleskin notebook, if you can imagine. So, you know, whatever, 5 inches
five
across.
By seven.
I'll draw a little, and I'll draw a little arc. And I will split it up. Usually I'll kind of zoom in, start zoomed out. So I'll start with sometimes as little as like the axe. I'll start with, okay, the basic idea, like with Glass Onion, spoiler alert, if anyone hasn't seen it yet, skip ahead.
Because three people.
Yeah. So, you know, it started with something as simple as the notion of the fugue structure. And that's what the whole movie was built on. So,
and hence the cameo from Yo-Yo Ma.
Exactly. Yeah. Explaining. Yeah, I was like, if anyone's going to explain a fugue, why not get Yo-Yo Ma? So you do the first half of the film and you tell the whole story. You do a hard reset right at the midpoint. And then you do the second half of the movie where you retell that same story from another perspective. And the challenge of, I mean, that is a good example of just a structural thing that every single story element ends up coming out of.
Is that something you learned or something that just became a thing? And I'm wondering too, as you're writing, are you listening to, you know, some fugues by, I don't know, Bach? Does that help you?
I'm a big Bach fan, so I'm generally, I'll be listening to Bach a lot of the time.
Is that true?
I love Bach. I've kind of delved in the past 5 years into classical music. Opera was kind of my gateway into getting more into classical. And so, yeah, but also, you know, a fan not only of Bach, but Gotel, Escher, Bach. Yeah, the puzzle nerds love to talk about Bach because Bach, you know, famously, like in his music, he would put hidden messages, and there's an element of cryptology to his writing. And he was kind of the first music nerd a little bit. So which was another reason why it made a lot of sense to kind of reference him in this movie.
I was talking with Kate Blanchett about Tar the other day, and she said, in speaking about Todd Field, the writer-director, that often when you get on set, the director, if he or she is the writer, will start saying, well, we don't have to do that. Let's do something else. And that Kate said, it's very important for the actor to say, you wrote it. It must mean something. Let's see if we can figure out a way to do what you wrote. And has that ever happened on set that as the director, it's like, I don't know. Let's do this instead. But the writer, in the privacy or quiet of his own mind or home or working space, has an idea that maybe you shouldn't ditch when it's when other things come into play. Has that happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, that also, it has. Daniel Craig keeps me honest in that regard. And because when I get on set, it is almost like the person that wrote the script becomes a different person in my head. And I think because it was me, I don't feel precious at all about what's on the page. When I get on set, I do tend to want to explore it, and if it's not working, find something else. And sometimes I will even make the leap of, okay, why don't we try this or that. And I mean, in the first Knives Out, there was a kind of an extended monologue that Daniel had about a donut hole that I was very excited about in writing, and that I almost cut during rehearsals because I thought, well, it's at the point in the movie where we kind of just want to get the ending going, and I kind of second guessed myself. And that was Daniel pulled a Lydia Tarr. He said, no, I think this is really good and really important for Blanc. I was like, oh, well. And then I saw him do it. I was sitting at the monitor just thinking, oh my God, thank God he talked me back into that.
That's Ryan Johnson, writer-director of Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery, talking with our John Horn. We'll have more of their conversation in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Let's return to Ryan Johnson, writer-director of the new Knives Out sequel, Glass Onion, in conversation with our John Horn.
I want to play a clip from Glass Onion. This is a conversation between Birdie, played by Kate Hudson, and Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc.
I'm a truth teller. Some people can't handle it.
It's a dangerous thing to mistake speaking without thought for speaking the truth, don't you think?
Are you calling me dangerous?
So what's interesting about this scene is that Kate's character has no idea that she's just been insulted. A lot of the characters in this story are operating on a different level intellectually, however you want to decide it, than Benoit is. And the question is, he is the smartest guy in the room. But the other people, if they're dumb, it's not as interesting. So how do you walk that line between his being smart and their not being, like, laughably misinformed and I guess, stupid?
I guess it's a two-part answer. I guess the first part is I still have to find my way inside each of them. Like with Birdie, for example. Yeah, she's oblivious, but she's also in her own way incredibly savvy. And there's something that I talked about with Kate, with her, which she's a survivor and she's savvy. And there is also something very sad and lonely at the heart. So something kind of needy in a way that I know I could relate to. And that helped me get in the character while I was writing it. Second part is casting Kate Hudson right in that part, you know, just like casting Edward Norton to play Miles or Catherine Hahn to play Claire. At the instant you put a incredibly smart actor into that role, suddenly it has an inner, that part has an inner life, and all of those layers that I talked about then, the writing can come out.
Well, let's talk about casting, because I think that's really interesting. Your casting directors are Mary Vernieu and Brett Howe. Do I say their names right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Where do you start? I mean, do you have people in mind as you're writing outside of Daniel Craig, character types? How does that conversation work between you and your casting directors?
Well, while I'm writing, I try really hard not to think about actors because first of all, it can be a pathway to heartbreak if you can't get the ones you're thinking of. But also, I feel like then I'm just modeling it based on another performance I've seen the actor. So it doesn't seem fair. So I try and just write characters, and I'll think of other people in my life. I'll think of people who aren't actors. I will have types and kind of references in my head, and all of those will come out when I sit down with the script and have my first conversation with Mary and Brett. And then Mary will, you know, make her lists. She'll make, you know, lists of who's around and who she thinks she can be interesting. And sometimes it's like spot on. Yes, that's fantastic. This person is exactly what I was thinking. And sometimes like with the case of Dave Bautista in this movie, I wrote that to be played. I figured that would be played by a skinny white guy.
Really?
Yeah, I imagine that part being like somebody who's spouting all this nonsense, you know, mandom stuff, but is punching above his weight class. And when Mary suggested Dave for it, I just thought, oh my God, that's fantastic.
Knives Out came out in 2019, which is obviously the last pre-pandemic year. A lot has changed in the world, and a lot has changed in the way that people watch movies. So there's the physical changes of how the business has changed, and then there's the kind of cultural health changes that the world has gone through. Do any of those affect the way that you're thinking about the movie and releasing the movie?
Well, I mean, yeah, the big change of, you know, the pandemic we all went through, that literally affected, and that I rooted into the movie. That was one kind of, you know, big dilemma I had when I started writing back in 2020. But I kind of figured, well, the marching orders for these movies are to take this genre and set it in the here and now. And this is the one big thing that's happening to all of us right here and now. So figuring out a way to work it in so that it still worked within this kind of light confection, I guess. But in terms of, you know, what you're talking about with the way the world has changed, either business-wise or the way people watch movies or the notion of it being a streaming world and what's happening to theatrical, I don't think I'm smart enough to do that math and adjust what I'm actually making for that. I think at the end of the day, you know, I'm making movies for audiences, and I'm making movies to try and entertain audiences. And I really am genuinely creatively engaged by doing the Hitchcock thing of playing the audience like a piano and giving them a true roller coaster ride.
In the first 3 weeks that this movie has been on the service, it has been viewed, and I just looked, 171.5 million hours, which I guarantee you is more than any Star Wars movies you might have worked on. And Reed Hastings, the head of Netflix, actually admitted that what he thought was a kind of promotional tactic for the theatrical release, should have been in theaters longer. This is one of those weird things where it could have done even more business in theaters, and it's doing great business on the service. Do you pay attention to that at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, in terms of the theatrical element of it, I mean, first of all, I should say that what Netflix did with the week in theaters, even though it was just a week, I also was very conscious that they were making a big effort, that they stepped out of their comfort zone to do that, because it was a week in theaters, but it was the first time they worked with the big three chains. Right. It was the first time they put actual money and muscle behind promoting a theatrical run of a film. They had never done that before, really. And so they made an effort, and this was very much a test for them. And then I was very much paying attention. And first of all, because I want people to see it. You want people to like it. I also, though, really wanted to do well when it hit the service, to illustrate that you can have both, and that the theatrical element can complement and make it even more valuable when it's the service.
You have worked on original films, the first Knives Out, certainly Looper, and you've also worked on sequels or franchises, The Last Jedi and now Glass Onion. Is there a different challenge, satisfaction in doing something that's part of an ongoing story versus creating something original?
No, I don't feel, in terms of what actually happens within that frame of the film, you're still trying to leave it all on the table. You're still trying to kind of put every idea you've got in there and leave the audience truly satisfied by the end of it. And with these films, with Knives Out and Glass Onion, it's even more so. I mean, what excites me about it is not the idea of serialized kind of, you know, the F word franchise, I kind of, you know, shrink from a little bit just because I can't think of it that. For me, it's just each one is a new movie, and I'm trying to do something with each of them that is scary to me in the good way, in the way of, I don't know, I wonder if I can make this work.
When you think about puzzles, because you mentioned that word earlier, are you thinking about some of the things I'm obsessed with, the New York Times spelling bee, Or are you talking more about Agatha Christie in terms of the way that your mind works, the kind of puzzles you like to work on or play?
Well, I do the New York Times crossword every day. So I am just a genuinely a puzzle nut. But one of the things in terms of the way I try and approach these things is to get away from what I think is the illusion that the pleasure of a whodunit for the audience is laying out a string of clues and they can possibly solve it at the end. That needs on some level to be true, but I think that's never going to be the entertaining thing for an audience. And if you count on it to be, you're going to have a bored audience, I think, after about 20 minutes. It's fun to kind of look for the clues about 20 minutes, and then you're like, okay, what's actually happening? I think that's why with both of these films, building a narrative engine into it that is much more of a Hitchcock style, leaning forward in your chair as opposed to leaning back and trying to solve it. But at the same time, I think similar to a magic trick, there are just elements of how a good storytelling works that line up with kind of the mystery of presenting a puzzle box and, okay, let's get in and figure out what's actually ticking beneath that surface.
Writer-director Rian Johnson, his new film Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery, talking with our John Horn. The film is streaming on Netflix. If you missed any of our Film Week reviews this week with our critics or any of John's conversation with Rian Johnson, just head to kpcc.org or wherever you get your podcasts for the full hour of Film Week on KPCC. From all of us, have a terrific weekend.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.